Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Crocher. While violence is a perennial topic of concern, very little has been done on violence in rural society. That's why health researcher Judith Kulig of Lethbridge is talking to rural teens to find out how violence impacts on their lives. And neuropsychologist Glenn Presky is turning his attention to rats. Their innate ability to swim may one day lead to better treatment for poor vision in humans. And Ken Plourd talks about some of the innovative work his company, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, is engaged in to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Whether you're watching a TV show or listening to the news, violence is the order of the day. It's taken for granted that the larger an urban center becomes, the more violence you'll find. At the other extreme, people often think of rural communities as being bucolic and peaceful. Well, that's not exactly the viewpoint Judith Kulig holds. She's an associate professor in the School of Health Sciences at the University of Lethbridge. And with funding from the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, she's embarked on a study to look at violence among teens in rural Alberta.
Well, I guess there was a couple of reasons for motivation in terms of addressing this issue. One is that in general, unfortunately, we haven't got a lot of really good information about rural people in this country. There's very few studies that are done that really specifically look at what's going on in rural areas. So that was one issue we wanted to attend to. Another thing is we knew that, and we know in general, as the public knows, that violence in general in our society is an ongoing concern. And whether that be the big kind of things like the terrorist attacks or the everyday issues that unfortunately school kids deal with, such as bullying, we know what's going on. But we don't know what's going on in the rural area in terms of violence. Our statistics around violence tend to be taken from urban populations. The studies have been done in urban populations, or if they have been done in rural communities, they've either been done in the U.S., which cannot be extrapolated to this country, or in our instance in this country, there has been, we could only find one published study done about rural violence, but it was done from the definition of violence from the researcher and not the youth.
Why do you think that rural people in Canada have been overlooked in this way?
Well, there's few people in the rural communities compared to in the urban areas. It's not been a political agenda item on the national front for a number of years. Right now, it's been more of interest to people nationally since Alan Rock did a few things being Minister of Health. He actually created an Office of Rural Health and talked about the disparities between rural and urban people. That was kind of the beginnings. There have been some national research funding bodies created, like the Canadian Institutes of Health Research that has been mandated to be more rural focused, and so their institutes are addressing the notion of rural. So just in general, there hasn't been the money, there hasn't been the interest, and those of us that have been working in rural have been doing it very independently, spread across the country with not a lot of chances to sort of get together and talk about those issues.
The work that you're doing now, this research project, it's in cooperation with the University of Calgary, and you do have funding from the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. Mm-hmm. How are you setting up the project, the research, and what are you actually going to look at?
Okay, you're certainly right that it is a collaborative project. Barry Hall, who's a professor in the Faculty of Social Work at University of Calgary, who is on site here at Lethbridge because he's in charge of the division here, he and I are the co-principal investigators. Ruth Grant Kalischuk is also in the School of Health Sciences, and she's a co-investigator. And then we have several partners from the community, Paul Hasselback, Medical Officer of Health for Chinook Health Region, Larry Matheson at Winsong Child Services, Gwen Noble at the Sun Country Services are all involved with us in this project. And we're going to do a couple of different things. The first year of the project, we're going to be doing in-depth open-ended interviews with youth ages 11 to 19 in two small communities in southern Alberta. And we think it's very important that the youth tell us themselves what is violence. They may have a completely different definition of violence than what is already found in the literature. So, and the other thing is that in general, rural youth in this country have said that they don't have a voice and that no one has given them a chance to talk about what their issues are living in a small town. So we're giving them that chance. So we're going to do 60 interviews. And we have two research assistants hired that will go out to those communities, get to know the youth, and do those interviews. We've already had community meetings in those places. It's very important for us to have community collaboration and community support. When we have those interviews done and we analyze all of that information, we're going to go back to the youth and talk with them about what we found out. And we're going to invite in those communities local decision makers like the mayors and the RCMP and the teachers and so on to say to them, okay, this is what the youth told us. What can you do in your community to address those issues? Because some of the questions that we will ask about is, if violence is an issue in your community, what are the resources to help you if you were a victim of violence, for example? And maybe that community is lacking in some kind of service or resource or program. And maybe the decision makers in those communities can come up together with the youth to create some programs that are very innovative. Once all that is done, and kind of simultaneously at the end, we're going to create a questionnaire that will then go out to 360 youth in three other rural communities in central Alberta to try to find out if other youth have the same ideas in terms of violence and what's going on, what the definitions are, what's their experiences with it, and what kind of resources they need.
The youth that you will be interviewing, first of all, will they just be picked randomly, or do you have a specific youth in mind in terms of a profile?
It won't be a random sample, but what we will do is go to centers and places where the youth hang out and ask them to be involved. So we'll go to the school classrooms and talk to the kids there about the study that's going on, youth centers, teen centers, drop-in centers, and what have you. In addition, we have a webpage, and the webpage talks about the study, and it talks about how youth can be involved and be interviewed, so they can email us back if they're interested. And in addition, we have a toll-free number for youth or other people to call and just comment about the study as well.
In a sense, is this a fishing expedition, or do you have specific concerns, other than the fact that this is an area that you don't have a lot of information on, that would lead you to think that violence is an issue here?
I think we really are being open-minded to find out what is out there. I mean, anecdotally, we know that violence is a concern in small towns as it is in urban areas, but we just don't know the extent of it. I think the real key thing about the study is that youth get to tell us what it is and what's going on, and that communities will have information to use and to work with each other to sort out problems. And they don't have to wait until the end of the 2 years to do that. At the end of the first year, those first phase of interviews, they can make some decisions right then that affect their community. Then we'll go to the other communities with the questionnaire. We'll have community meetings before we do that questionnaire. We'll do those survey questionnaires with the students, analyze that, and then return to those communities as well to say, here's some information. What can you do in your own community?
From your experience, what is the outfall of violence for youth?
In terms of being a victim, of course, it's all that psychological, emotional, physical effects of being a victim of violence. And we don't know whether or not small communities have all the resources to deal with that. We know, for example, that in small towns, when they've attempted to create women's shelters or so on to deal with family violence, it's been a concern because you're never anonymous in a small town. So if you're a youth and you've been a victim of violence, no matter if it was from your parent or from a fellow classmate or whatever it is, who do you go to for help so that you have some confidentiality? And that is a huge concern.
One of the other concerns has been the high level of suicide amongst youths. What's happening there?
Well, again, certainly that's a really good point, that suicide has been an issue among youth. This study, we hope, will give us some more information to attend to that so that perhaps we can have some preventive programs or some intervention programs to impact on that rate of suicide.
And that would also be an outfall of violence and the result of someone who's, I mean, we've certainly seen in the news a number of items about teenagers who have killed themselves because they've been bullied so much at school.
Yeah, exactly. exactly right. And again, I think the more information we have about this, the more information we have from youth themselves, and particularly in this rural context, the more powerful we can be as people to decide what can we do next.
Well, I wish you luck with the study. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Judith Kulig, an associate professor in the School of Health Sciences at the University of Lethbridge. Her study is funded by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. Rats swim to leave a sinking ship, and they'll swim to get out of the water. That's a trait that Dr. Glenn Prusky is banking on in his study that hopefully will lead to a better treatment for degenerative eye disease. Now, this seemed like a huge leap in logic to me, so Glenn picked up a couple of his favorite rats, and I followed him over to the rat swim tank at the Center for Neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge.
These rats are females, I believe, and what they have been trained to do is to recognize and differentiate between information that's placed on two separate screens here. So in fact, there are these bars on one screen and gray on the other, and they've been trained to recognize the bars, and they swim directly towards them and to avoid going to the gray.
You have two computer screens in the lab setup, and they have the stripes on them, but they change, don't they?
Yeah. In fact, when we're testing them, what we do is we start off with one screen with very, very few, very widely spaced stripes on it. And once the animals can recognize that effectively from the gray screen, then we increase the number of those bars on the screen until a point is reached when they really can't tell the screen with the bars on from the one with the gray. It's very much like when on an eye chart you can't tell a lot of the letters apart because, in fact, they all blur together. Effectively, what's happening here is as the number of the bars increases on the screen, it fades to gray for these animals.
How do you entice them to go from one end to the other and choose?
I wouldn't say entice is really the word. The fact is these animals know how to swim before we ever get to them. So swimming is not something we need to train them for, but they have a natural capability when they're swimming to want to get out of the water. And so what we do is effectively provide a place for them to get out of the water. And that place is actually right directly below the screen that has the bars on it. So we put the animals in. At first, of course, they're sort of confused. They swim around, but they very quickly learn that wherever those bars are is a place to get out of the water. Once you've done that for a few number of trials, the animals rarely make a mistake doing that. Effectively, what we do after that is to then increase the number of bars on the screen until a point where they fail. And when they fail, that's when we know that, in fact, they can't see what we've put on the screen. So we entice them, I guess, if you will, in that we give them a place to get out of the pool, but they naturally have all those capabilities already built in.
What would be the point of that?
The point of it is that, one, that these animals can be trained to discriminate between different pieces of information. But specifically here, we're actually testing their vision, very much like you test the vision, or like an optometrist would test your vision. We're testing and quantifying how well they can actually see.
How might this be applied then in work that you would do for human health concerns?
A lot of people ask, well, gee, you know, do rats see anything, and why would you use them at all? The answer to the first question is, of course, they see. And what we've done is be able to, we developed a technique that allows us to actually quantify what they can see. And what this allows us to do now is to use all of the other qualities that a rat has to study various aspects of brain processing. Specifically, these animals that you see here, we're studying them as a model of a human retinal degenerative disorder called age-related macular degeneration. And so in humans, The leading cause of blindness actually is the loss of retinal function in adults. And we have a rat model that mimics that, in that these animals start off seeing fairly well, but then over time their vision degenerates. And so what we do is we've developed a technique where we can rescue some of that loss, and in fact that translates into these animals having better vision. And so it allows us to test a lot of possible treatments for these human disorders, and before we ever get to humans, and to work out a lot of the problems and effectively try to cure a human disease.
Let's see how these rats swim.
All right. You want to put them in? Normally we have the lights off.
So you're doing this in the dark?
Well, yeah, the screens provide light here, but it really focuses the animal's attention on the screens when it's darkened in the room. But you can see the animal goes into the pool here. What it does is it goes up to the barrier, looks, and very nicely makes its choice to get out of the pool on the screen that has the bars.
He's very quick.
Oh, yeah. They're highly trained. You can see they're very calm when they go in there, look the wrong way, then all of a sudden saw the correct side and went there. So that's really no problem for them at all. Maybe we can switch the sides. So just to show you that it's not some random behavior these animals have, you can see we switched the sides, and of course we move where the platform goes. And so put the animal in. You see it's nice and calm.
Oh!
Knows really that it's not there. He wanted to go there, but correctly went and chose the other side.
Do they do this every time they get the right one?
They're not 100% accurate, but at the very easy discriminations, they're virtually perfect. But as you increase the difficulty of the task of putting more bars on the screens, it's not like they just fail at one point. They start to make progressively more errors. And when, in fact, the number of errors falls below a criterion we set, then we call that their what they see. It's really not an all or none function. It's more like a psychophysical function, as it's called. It's really describing a curve. But it's the same as with you. Just because you see 20/20 does not mean you see everything equally well on all days. These are similar in that they're not absolutely perfect all the time, but if you test them long enough, you'll find a place where they reliably fail, and it's that point there that we call their acuity.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Glenn Preske, a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Lethbridge. A lot of effort is underway these days to find innovative ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. One company that has been having a great deal of success in this area is Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. Ken Bluard is the Director of Forest Strategies for ALPAC.
When they formed Climate Change Central in 1999, and Al Amy in Calgary became the head of it, and they started putting it all together, ALPAC formed a parallel organization within ALPAC called ALPAC's Carbon Central Team. So we formed a team with people from all parts of the operation, in the mill, process engineers, effluent people, environmental people, and scientists, and we formed our own climate change organization within the mill and built a business plan and started tracking climate change initiatives and concerns to see what ALPAC itself could do to position ourselves in a good business position, depending on what way the political climate went in the future. And that's talking from a 1999 perspective.
Why would you think that's an important thing?
Well, number one, as you know, ALPAC's an environmentally sensitive or environmentally committed company. And air emissions are a valid environmental concern, and dealing with greenhouse gas and global warming seemed to us that it would fit together with our other environmental practices, so that we would cover all the bases, and it's become an important part of our environmental program.
Well, certainly trees are a big part of it, and as a forest company, you're dealing with trees. And from a carbon sink point of view and reduction of greenhouse gases, trees fit into that as well. Perhaps you could explain that a bit more.
We have a tremendous forest management area, as you know, out there with bogs and fens and wetlands, and we have a tremendous carbon sink out there. So one of our challenges is to protect that carbon sink while we're carrying out our operations, our harvesting operations. And of course, we have other things in place to protect the environment or to reduce the footprint on the environment, the industrial footprint, and reducing the impact on the carbon sink that's out there and making more trees grow faster to sequester more carbon becomes an important part of that whole forestry process.
What are some of the things that you're actually doing?
Well, to start with the FMA, our ecosystem management principles support protecting carbon sinks to some extent. We leave material standing and growing in the bush, and we have a reduced reforestation delay, where some companies have 3 to 5 years before they get trees growing back in the cutover areas. We have an immediate response the next year for trees growing back in. So the transportation, our second biggest emitter at ALPAC is our transportation system, transporting our logs to the mill. And we've looked at quite a few initiatives that are gaining a lot of interest out there in the community right now. We have some road stabilization stuff where we do reduce maintenance and reduce travel time on the road, which saves a lot of carbon. We've developed a larger truck through FERIC, Forest Engineering Research Institute of Canada. We've developed a larger truck with a larger payload. Once again, there's a 15 to 17% reduction in emissions per unit of trucking. So with those initiatives, our central tire inflation, and we have a Traxxas system on our trucks. We keep track of driver efficiencies, and the central tire reduces road wear and reduces emissions. And all these little things, you put them all together into a package, which we call our transportation package. They all go together to reduce emissions significantly in our operation.
How about within the plant itself?
In the plant, we've done quite a few things, and I'm not a plant guy, but I can tell you that we've reduced our amount of gas that we burn in the plant to fire up the boilers and so on. And we've replaced the natural gas with solid wood waste from the mill, and we're recycling black liquor and solid wood waste through the system to produce electricity and heat to run the mill. So what we're doing is recycling wood waste, producing electricity, and we're also exporting up to 6 megawatts of electricity into the Alberta grid. And we're checking into that now to see if it qualifies as green power. And one of our dreams might be to supply green power to one of the local communities out near the mill.
Are you working in partnership at all with any other companies or industry groups?
We have partnerships with our local industries and local groups that we have out there with us. We're not working in partnership with any major companies per se, except an information exchange and whatnot. But we have a partnership with Kikino Métis Settlement, for example, where we have plantations growing with them. And we have the Pemina Institute looking at other opportunities for Kikino in terms of building solar heat greenhouses or raising fish for commercial fish for the city of Edmonton, for example. So we do have some initiatives like that with local communities, Kikino Métis Settlement being one of them, and we have partnerships with Tree Canada Foundation and Shell Canada, where we're growing trees and in partnership with them, and we would get the fiber and Shell would have the greenhouse gas credits from those plantations. Another partner in that process is Ducks Unlimited, where we're looking at greening up the what we call the transition zone between the boreal forest and the agricultural area in Alberta, be around St. Paul, Lac La Biche, Bonnyville, all through that transition area where the trees are disappearing and there's a lot of marginal land just sitting there. So we're looking at partnerships with landowners and Tree Canada again and Ducks Unlimited to green up and protect the habitat there and put some forests back in those lands, which would be a tremendous carbon sink as well.
Carbon credits are sometimes lauded as being a good thing and other times not. How do you look at them?
Well, as you know, the Kyoto thing is up in the air right now, and what we'll be able to do with our carbon credits is somewhat of a question, although carbon credits are a recognized commodity that's trading now in the States and internationally, and a lot of large companies have bought carbon credits. What ALPAC is doing is striving toward becoming carbon neutral and not an emitter, and we hope to be there. Our consultants tell us that are calculating the numbers, we hope to be there by 2009, and we think we can beat that target. So at that time, we would feel then that we would have something to sell, and depending on what Canada does and what Alberta does, we'd like to position ourselves so that we have it a marketable product if we choose as a company to sell these credits.
How on earth do you keep track of all that if you are looking at any gains that you've made in terms of cutting back on emissions or even how to keep track of the credits?
Firstly, we have some pretty good consultants, and one of the major project that we did this past year was have PEMDA Institute come in and do a life cycle analysis of our whole operation. They did our mill, our woodlands, our road construction, our delivery systems, our transportation. They did the whole ball of wax, and so they've come up with some pretty reliable numbers as to what situation we're in the various phases of our operation in terms of carbon balance. And they also took a look at our plantation program, which is a very carbon positive thing, the plantations where we're growing hybrid poplars on our own land there. And they suck up a lot of carbon in a year. So that's what's going to really help us to become carbon neutral. And keeping track of that, there's a lot of science behind it. We've worked with the Prairie Farm Rehabilitation folks in Indian Head and some other scientists, and we know how much carbon the various trees take up as they grow, the fast-growing trees, and they're roughly 50% carbon, and the roots and whatnot, and we do sampling ourselves as well. So we have a pretty good measure of how much greenhouse gas we're collecting and saving or reducing, depending on what part of the program you look at.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thank you.
I was speaking with Ken Plourde, the Director of Forest Strategies for Alberta Pacific Forest Industries. Since I conducted this interview with Ken, ALPAC has announced yet another initiative which will save on greenhouse gas emissions. In December, the company will start hauling a significant portion of its logs by train instead of truck. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. You can download past programs from our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can also subscribe to our weekly online newsletter. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the University of Lethbridge, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Alberta Ingenuity, the Alberta Research Council, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, True North Energy, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Health Sciences Association of Alberta, and the Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.